You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Coming up, mistakes made in healthcare are a lot more common than we might think. A recent study from Johns Hopkins found over 250,000 Americans die each year due to medical error. We talk with a Wisconsin filmmaker about his new documentary looking into the problem.
First, a federal judge in Texas struck down the Affordable Care Act on Friday, ruling that it's unconstitutional. 20 states, including Wisconsin, filed a lawsuit earlier this year following Congress's removal of the tax penalty for not being insured in 2017.
The plaintiffs, led by Texas, said that with no tax penalty for the individual mandate, the rest of the law couldn't stand either because the various parts of the ACA couldn't be separated. And the judge ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. But because of the appeal process, the ACA remains in place.
Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's also co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back.
Always good to be here.
Well, I want to hit that last point we made first. The judge made this ruling, but as of now, the Affordable Care Act is still in place, right?
That's right. So California and several other intervener states have appealed the ruling. And while that appeal is pending in the Fifth Circuit, the decision is not going to take effect. And the federal government has said that they are going to continue to enforce the law. So you can still sign up for insurance. Medicaid expansion still exists. And all of the benefits sort of created by the Medicare portion of the ACA still exists. So the law is still the law of the land.
Now, it's kind of a complicated constitutional argument. The Supreme Court had upheld the individual mandate under Obamacare because of the tax part of it. They said that, okay, yes, the government can do that. Congress got rid of the penalty for the individual mandate. And it ended up being here that the judge said not just that, okay, part of Obamacare would have to go away, the Affordable Care Act, but because one part is unconstitutional, the whole thing goes. And that's a lot of parts, right?
This is a really convoluted ruling, and it's very hard to understand, and different parts of the ruling don't really jibe with one another. So the first thing that the judge did was said that the plaintiffs in the case had standing because the penalty-free mandate was unduly coercive. So effectively, once Congress zeroed out the penalty for the mandate, what happened to you if you didn't get health insurance under the ACA was you had to pay a penalty of $0. Well, the judge here said that that's unconstitutional because that's unduly coercive. At the same time, however, he says that because the penalty is now $0, it's no longer a tax. So that coercive thing, when we're talking about the substance of the law, no longer makes sense. And what I think is even more difficult to understand than that is that the judge said that when Congress zeroed out the penalty for the individual mandate back in 2017 with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that what they really intended to do was to eliminate the entire law, because he argued that that the individual mandate, everyone knew how important it was to the law. But when you go back and look at the votes that were cast on any of the repeal and replace plans, Republicans did not have anything close to the number of votes necessary to do the sort of larger repealing and replace plans. In fact, they only had the votes, less than 50, to do, or 50 exactly, to do what they did to the individual mandate. So it's a pretty convoluted ruling, and one that even anybody modestly familiar with the history of the ACA will find very, very difficult to take seriously.
Talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University, looking at a judge in Texas ruling the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. It is still in effect. Phil, I imagine this is going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, but if they agreed with this judge's decision, it's a big if, what would happen here in Wisconsin? What are some of the biggest changes we would see in Wisconsin healthcare?
I mean, the biggest changes that you're going to see in Wisconsin, if the judges on the Supreme Court agreed with this particular version of the ruling, it means something not just for the people who gained coverage under the ACA. So if you gained coverage under the ACA, you purchased a plan on the individual marketplace, you won't be able to do that anymore. You won't get any subsidies to help you purchase insurance. You won't also be protected if you have a pre-existing condition. So those are the things that are pretty familiar to people. Another important thing is if you have a child who is under the age of 26, they won't be able to be on your health insurance anymore. This might be a little bit more in the weeds for folks who might take it for granted. But there's a bunch of other things that the law did that affected people who are 65 and older. So, for instance, the assistance for people who are on Medicare to pay for prescription drugs, that sort of closing the Part D donut hole, as it's called, that'll also be gone. And it's important to remember that health insurance is a significant, or health care generally is a significant part of the entire country's economy, including the economy of Wisconsin. And this law being repealed will transform how that works. And it's pretty difficult to find a historical analog to where the Supreme Court has repealed something that in a way that sort of unstructured how a significant portion of our economy works.
Now, you'd reacted to this ruling on Twitter, Phil, and to the long effort to repeal or end the Affordable Care Act by one means or another. You say there's a fundamental message here about social policy in the United States. What is that?
Well, I think the fundamental message about social policy is, you know, the ACA isn't perfect, right? There are still a lot of problems with the law. For a lot of folks, they were really helped by the ACA, and for other folks, they're still paying probably unaffordable costs to receive health care. But what this ruling signifies is that we're not really having a debate over the substance of the ACA. We're having a debate over a pretty laughable interpretation of the constitutionality of the law. And I think it's important to think about why are we having that debate? And why has the sort of Obamacare wars, as the title of our book suggests, why have they not ended? And I think it's important to think about this here, which is that the Affordable Care Act is not an especially radical policy. It leaves most of the structure of our health insurance and healthcare system in place and provide some wedges to allow individuals who weren't able to get care to get it. But what Republicans' opposition to the law, I think, suggests is not the opposition to the specifics or the details of what the law does, which are, you know, again, pretty moderate and were drawn from a plan that was actually a bipartisan plan in Massachusetts. Their opposition to the law, I think all of these debates over it suggest, is an opposition to what the law does to the sort of cognitive understanding of what the government's role in healthcare should be. When you look at public opinion, most people think that it's important that the government, including the federal government, protect people who have pre-existing conditions. Once that exists in the public mind, then the federal government could be on the hook for a great deal more involvement in the healthcare system, and for the primary donors in the Republican Party, who are really interested in lowering taxes on the sort of richest Americans, that is not a policy futurescape that they are particularly interested in entertaining. And so the opposition, I think you're seeing here, is sort of trying to keep the focus on the legitimacy of the law and trying to keep Democrats away from actually proposing reforms to try to change it or fix it, Medicare for all, or even something much more modest that would sort of tinker around the edges with the ACA. The idea is to keep the focus on the legitimacy of the law.
We'll leave it there for now. Phil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks.
That's Phil Rocco, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He's co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. He joined us today to dig into the continued fight over the future of health coverage in the United States after a judge ruled that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional.
Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin filmmaker whose new documentary takes a personal look at the cost of mistakes made in the healthcare industry. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Coming up, why are we so angry? Our guest digs into anger in American politics to find the roots of extreme polarization and some possible solutions.
First, a study last year from Johns Hopkins University attributed over 250,000 deaths in the U.S. per year to medical errors. That could include things like inadequate training for hospital staff, bad judgment by doctors, or a mix-up on medications. But pursuing legal action when things go wrong is costly and, for the most part, unsuccessful.
Our next guest made a documentary on the subject after his mother, Judy Burroughs, suffered severe problems following a hip surgery at a West Allis hospital in 2009.
Mom fell and I think she broke her hip. The ambulance is on the way.
When my mom went into the hospital for a routine partial hip replacement,
he knew something was wrong.
The neurologist told us mom is in a coma, and now it's brutally clear. I need a lawyer.
Those complications stemmed from heavy blood loss, which may have been caused by a blood-thinning drug Burroughs was on at the time of the surgery. Following the operation, dangerous blood pressure levels went unaddressed by staff in the ICU, leaving her with permanent physical and cognitive damage.
Steve Burroughs is a comedy director from Milwaukee. He produced, wrote, and directed the documentary Bleed Out, which premieres tonight at 7 o'clock on HBO. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Steve, a hip surgery isn't something we expect will lead to brain damage. So what was it that initially went wrong with your mother's care?
Well, you know, there were many things. There, you know, it started kind of before her surgery, then the transfer, then into the ICU, and then to this thing called the EICU. I think as I look back now through the whole thing after 10 years, I think the biggest problem that I can see is that I don't know who was in charge of my mom's care through this whole thing. You know, I don't know the answer to that question after all these years.
You know, one of the more shocking things in your mom's care was, you know, not only not knowing, you know, who was responsible for her care, but also that the records from her surgery, according to multiple medical experts, seemed to be falsified. What happened there?
You know, That's something I wish I had an answer to that. I don't know. All I can tell you is that all those years ago, my uncle, who's a doctor, and my aunt, who's a nurse, they were with me at the time when mom was going through the surgery. And my uncle had me, you know, when we found out she was in a coma, my uncle had me become power of attorney and had me get the medical records right away and had me seek counsel. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I'm just a comedy guy from L.A.
Sure.
Just making a fool of myself for a living. And next thing you know, I'm being told that my mom may never wake up. So my uncle looked at some of these records, and they just didn't add up to him for what I'm not a doctor, and I'm certainly not an attorney. But as you see in the film, there are many experts that agree with my uncle that these things, you know, certain records don't make any medical sense. In fact, one person even said it was virtually medically impossible, but I don't have a good answer for you on that.
Now, I know you decided to take legal action pretty quickly, and despite having what seems like a convincing case of several doctors and nurses making mistakes, finding an attorney to take on a malpractice lawsuit for you was tough. Why was that?
Well, you know, the system, to quote one of the attorneys, one of our very first attorney that we had, he said it best, the system is rigged. And I know that's an oversimplification, but with regards to patients, when something goes wrong, because of the laws, certainly in the state of Wisconsin, and also, you know, nationally, but specifically in our case in the state of Wisconsin, there are many laws out there that protect hospitals and doctors and don't protect the patients. And so you've got that, but you also have these things called caps. The caps are on awards. So, for a lawyer, in our case, in a medical malpractice situation, these attorneys, the plaintiff attorneys representing families like ours, they're not going to get paid anything unless they win the case. So they only take the very, very best cases because, I mean, there's so many things that happen out there. And as I've learned, so many other families have experienced similar things. But when you're an attorney, the only way you're going to make money is if you win. And we also found out that these attorneys, they lose 90% of the time. So they're taking the very best cases, and they're losing nine out of 10 cases they're losing.
Wow.
So it's hard to convince a lawyer to, hey, you want to take our case and not get paid for 7 years and have a 90% chance of losing? And in our case, you know, we had not one but two great attorneys that, you know, believed in this case, and you know, we soldiered on.
Let's change the focus for just a few minutes to your mother. How did life for your mother change after the surgery that put her in a coma?
Well, Mom, you know, we didn't know if she was going to survive at first. And then, you know, she was in a coma for almost 2 weeks. And then as she slowly came out of this thing, it became very clear that she had, you know, severe cognitive and physical disabilities. She had to relearn how to walk and talk and eat. And she had over the next year or so, she had a limited recovery, but, you know, we found out that her executive functions, you know, her reasoning and judgment were severely affected. In fact, one of her doctors said she was not competent, which was a very difficult day for me to hear that. And also her legs, because of the lack of oxygen to the brain, she lost, she had massive blood loss in the surgery. She lost half the blood volume in her body during this surgery. And her legs don't work because of that. It's called spastic paraplegia. So Mom had not only cognitive issues, but she had physical issues where her legs really didn't work and her feet were locked on her tippy toes. So she was never safe. You know, she was kind of making bad decisions while she's not able to physically take care of herself. And the worst part about it was she didn't even realize it. You know, this thing she had, her brain injury did not allow her to realize that she actually has a brain injury. You know, she still doesn't believe it.
Steve Burrows is a comedy writer originally from Milwaukee. He produced, wrote, and directed the documentary Bleed Out, debuting tonight on HBO. Now, of course, your mom's case isn't an isolated incident. It seems like medical errors are a lot more common than we might think. And did you learn that in this journey?
I did. I didn't know anything about any of this stuff until I started digging. I thought our case was like an outlier case, like maybe this was a one-off somehow, or this was just our personal story. And then a few years into this thing, someone told me about a book called Unaccountable, written by Dr. Marty McCary out of Johns Hopkins. And he did this study where they found that medical error is the third leading cause of death in America after cancer and heart disease. And I didn't know that. They also found out that 1 in 4 patients are harmed by medical error in some fashion. I mean, never intentionally, but it just happens. And it's almost like an epidemic out there. And when I found out this, you know, this bigger picture thing where I thought it was all personal, but it's actually universal. And at some point it became clear to me that, I mean, I never really set out to make this film. This was not something I ever wanted to do. And in fact, I didn't do it for many, many years. I started gathering footage, but I didn't know if I would ever do anything with it. But the deeper I got in this, I really felt people needed to know this information that I found out. And that was really what kind of forced the issue for me, was the big picture.
Now, Steve, there was a lot of finger pointing and frankly, dishonesty from the folks involved in your mother's care. You even recorded some of their comments with a spy camera. But despite all of that, no one was found to be at fault for this. So a question a lot of people would ask when watching this unfold in the documentary is, how?
Oh, man. I've been asking that question. I'm asking that question right now. Like, I've been trying to find out, you know, as I started, who's in charge of my mom's care? I'm trying to find out who's in charge of health care. I don't know. I mean, I did my very best to try to get to the bottom of this thing. And just trying to have somebody be straight with me on this stuff. And I had the good fortune to go to the Mayo Clinic and interview one of the top doctors there. And they all preach the same thing. You know, when something goes wrong, regardless of what it is, you know, number one, be accountable. Two, be transparent. You know, learn from our mistakes. And three, also, you know, apology. Accountability, transparency, and apology. And that simple mantra kind of fixes everything. And, you know, in our case, it just, to go back to your question, I don't know. It didn't happen for us that way. And I tried. I mean, we all tried.
And finally, Steve, how has this ordeal over the last 10 years left you feeling? Are you fired up, hopeless, or somewhere in between?
I would say yes to all three. You know, I wake up an optimist, I go to bed a pessimist, and most of the day I'm kind of somewhere in between. I know that you know, the vast majority of doctors and hospitals and nurses, they're great. Everyone, you know, these are heroes. They really are heroes. They're saving lives every day, but they're human as well.
Right.
And humans make mistakes. And the question is, what do we do when we make those mistakes? And that's kind of the big question for me. I think anger's the thing that's kept me going all these years, because I've been so upset about what happened to my mom, and I can't help her. I've tried to make her as comfortable as possible, but you know, she lost everything. So I think the anger and trying to get to the truth has fueled me, and I'm glad we had this opportunity and that HBO gave me the opportunity to actually tell this story, because in the end, and I know I can speak for my mom on this, we really want to help people. You know, this is something we think people can learn from, and people can get better health care. And that's not just patients, that's doctors and hospitals, and you know, we really wanted to maybe even change some policy, maybe even make some policy, and maybe even save some lives.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Steve Burrows is the producer, writer, and director of Bleed Out, a documentary about errors in the healthcare system, a project he started after his mother suffered severe physical and cognitive damage after a hip surgery in West Dallas, that debuts tonight at 7 o'clock on HBO.
Coming up, it turns out being angry can help get things done, but too much anger in the wrong frame of mind can get us stuck. We hear from our guest who has sifted through decades of psychological research to find the roots of American anger in politics and beyond today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, airlines are trying to figure out how to handle passengers who want to bring their emotional support animals onto planes with them. A veterinarian joins the show for a look at the issue. That's tomorrow morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network.
First, in 2001, just 8% of Americans told Pew researchers that they were angry at the federal government. In 2013, that number had more than tripled. Our next guest says that's just one sign of the rise of anger in America.
And that anger was on the rise before Donald Trump ran for president, and it'll still be here when he leaves office. Charles Duhigg is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of The Power of Habit and Smarter, Faster, Better. His new piece in The Atlantic is The Real Roots of American Rage, the untold story of how anger became the dominant emotion in our politics and personal lives and what we can do about it. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you start off talking about, we worry about the negative impacts of anger, but there's a lot of research in the right way, used properly, anger can be a very positive and useful emotion. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that we know from studies by psychologists and sociologists about anger, which is that if people think back to the last time they expressed anger, odds are pretty good that A, it felt kind of good to be able to say what was on your mind, and B, that things got better right afterward, right? If you think about it, when most of the emotions that we have, they serve a really strong purpose in our life. And anger is one of those emotions that helps us express what we're really feeling, and it forces other people to listen really closely to us. And in general, because anger kind of comes out hot and furious, it tends to encourage other people to not only listen, but to become more willing to make compromises. And similarly, it sometimes surprises us and helps us really say what's on our mind and get it off our chest, and oftentimes helps us see solutions that we didn't see before. Within psychology, this is sometimes referred to as the good anger, right? It's the type of thing that has, for millennia, helped humans live together in societies. When things get too bad, we tend to shout and say, look, you got to take seriously the fact that I'm upset. Let's figure out how to make this better together. And someone who might have been ignoring what I was saying previously, suddenly now they're listening very closely.
And that's,
and if I'm the person who's shouting, it feels good.
And that's at the individual level. And you also share a lot of stories of anger kind of at the level of civil protest, the civil rights movement, the movement of farm workers in California, harnessing anger to alleviate injustices.
That's exactly right. So one of the things that we know is that this instinct that we have to shout when things are really upsetting us and to hopefully find some resolution, some catharsis as a result. A really talented leader often takes that and says, look, you're not angry about just one thing. You're actually angry without perhaps realizing it right now because society has been treating you a way that it shouldn't have. Let me put this in a broader context for you. That's where a sense of moral outrage comes from. And we know, as you mentioned, Cesar Chavez in the 1970s, the civil rights movement, particularly under Martin Luther King in the 1960s, right now with the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter, we see how societies can rally around a sense of ethical outrage, moral injustice, and draw on that to come together and persist in pushing for change. That good anger that I mentioned, oftentimes it fades as soon as we shout, right? We find some resolution, we shout at our spouse and they take us seriously and we work on making things better together because they want the shouting to stop. But when that shouting becomes persistent, when it is tied up in a bigger cause than just ourselves, we begin to believe in something, a movement, a sense of injustice that makes us upset and angry. And that persistent belief in it, that sense that things will get better if we continue shouting, that oftentimes can bring a group together to push for change. In fact, historically, particularly in the United States, it's been one of the few things that consistently has led to change.
Now, before we get to the downside of anger, bad and persistent anger, you touch on this point in the piece that sometimes we allow some people to express anger, white men in particular, and women, people of color, may be looked at differently when they express their anger, individually or socially.
That's right. So individually, one of the things that we know is that oftentimes when women express anger or people of color express anger in a crowd that is not otherwise women or people of color, that oftentimes they're penalized for expressing that anger. And so one of the things that we've seen develop is that people tend to sublimate their anger and express it differently based on the social place that they hold in that society. Now, that's changing, right? And part of that is the social justice movement. We've seen, again, with Black Lives Matter, a reclaiming of the ability to express anger among people of color, which was true in the 1960s and largely faded in mainstream culture since then. And that's really important because the more that we start thinking about anger as scientists, the more that we say this is an emotion that can be studied and can be parsed and can be understood, the more we begin to understand that anger expressions are actually really important. It's something we should listen to. And ultimately, the more we use that to enfranchise groups who historically have had to sublimate their anger. But the arc of progress, the arc of history, does seem to tend towards justice on this, right? We see more and more groups who are allowed to, rightfully, and it's been unfair in the past that they haven't been allowed to reclaim that anger, to seize it and use it to empower their voices. And oftentimes it goes hand in hand with that interpersonal anger and that social justice anger, that the good anger becomes something that we can all understand and that helps us communicate and live together as a society.
Talking to Charles Duhigg about his new piece in The Atlantic, The Real Roots of American Rage. Now let's get to the downside. The positive side, as you've been saying, we individuals or groups express anger, we get attention to an injustice, then we negotiate and we work it out. We're missing that last step, it sounds like. The off switch isn't there anymore. As a society, we are entering into some kind of, perpetual cycle of anger, if I'm reading you right.
Well, that's right. And so I think two things are happening. Nobody listening to this probably thinks that anger is universally good. And so the question is, when does it become bad? Well, the first way that it becomes bad is when it's not managed carefully. I mean, we know this in our own lives, right? But we also know it in social movements. that if you are angry and you shout at someone, and they respond by listening to you, but you just continue shouting, you don't manage your own anger, then it can become a fairly destructive thing. Similarly, in social movements, one of the things that leaders have to do, and that they've done very ably in the past, is they've managed that anger. A great example, again, is Cesar Chavez, right? He launched this angry movement in California among farm workers. And after a couple of years of gains, there was a lot of frustration. You know, the concessions by the farm owners that started to stall. People started getting so angry, particularly young people in the fields, that they began sabotaging, setting buildings on fire, attacking people who were crossing the picket line. And so Cesar Chavez knew how dangerous this anger was, how closely it had to be managed. And he actually announced that he was going to go on a fast in order to try and encourage his followers to commit themselves to nonviolent protests. For almost a full month, he fasted. He was a small man to begin with, and he started withering away. People were speculating that he would actually die. And when he finally did start taking in food again, he made a really beautiful speech that he actually wrote out. He was too weak to say it himself. But that said to the effect of, we need to be careful, because anger is a tool that we can use to unite us. But if we let anger overcome us, if we let it become the dominant emotion, if it replaces hope, then what happens is that we begin to turn on each other. We become destructive. We begin to undo the goals that we had in the first place. And that's the first way that anger can become destructive, is if we don't manage it ourselves, or if we don't have leaders who are willing to oftentimes make sacrifices, personal sacrifices, in order to help us understand how to use our anger and when to leave it alone.
We've got a media landscape now that seems to reward anger and outrage, whether we're talking about cable news or social media. Do you see that fueling a negative and perpetual cycles of anger?
Absolutely. And that's the second way that anger becomes so dangerous, is not just when it isn't being managed, but when people begin to believe, because they're told, that their anger will have no impact, that the system itself is broken. And one of the things that we've seen, that's when anger becomes not just outrage, it becomes an instinct for vengeance, for revenge. It's people saying, not just I want to express myself, but I want to beat the other guy because I have to take justice into my own hands. And what we know is that in the last 15 or 20 years in particular, cable news, political campaigns, the social networks that have emerged like Twitter and Facebook, they have found that there's a great deal of profit to be had in riling up that anger and never letting it die down. So one of the things that's happened within political campaigns is that consultants have come to believe, and polls show them that this is true, that outrage, that fear and anger are the best ways to convince people to show up in the voting booths. In fact, we just saw that in the midterms, right? People who are furious on the left and who are furious on the left showing up to vote in record numbers 2 years earlier, people on the right who are furious showing up to vote. The problem is that for political consultants, anger becomes the end in itself. There is no incentive for them to manage that anger into reconciliation, into catharsis. Rather, a perpetual anger makes it easier and easier for them to motivate voters. Similarly, one of the things that happened is that as the study of anger became more of a science, cable news was in its infancy and developing. And a producer at Fox told me that one of their early realizations was that when you hear anger, that it's very entertaining, right? Anyone who's ever watched reality television knows this. The best way to convert an indifferent crowd to paying attention to you is to shout something out loud or get in a fight. Well, they found that that worked, and in fact, it worked so well that when you see people on high-profile people, anchors on television, expressing your anger, agreeing that you have the right to be angry, that's really, really compelling. That became actually the basis for one of Fox's biggest hits initially, Bill O'Reilly's first program. But it's not just on the right that this happened. MSNBC discovered the same thing and started using the same formula. And then, of course, the social media platforms emerged, Twitter and Facebook. And what they found is that big expressions of emotion tend to go viral much faster than anything else. One of them is joy, so that's great. But another one that's actually much more powerful is anger. People will pay attention when they see angry things online. They will share angry things. They will participate in the anger. So although Twitter and Facebook might not say our policy is to support angry statements, what their algorithms do is they prioritize those statements because those statements tend to become more popular. They tend to go viral. And of course, for all of these folks, whether it be TV stations or Facebook and Twitter or political consultants, they're doing it because they get money or power for doing so, right? The longer I can keep you watching my channel, the longer I can keep you on my platform, the more money I make, the more advertisements I can show you. The longer I keep you enraged and get you into the voting booth, the longer my party or my guy or my gal stays in power.
We're talking with Charles Duhigg. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He wrote the piece. We're talking about the real roots of American rage. That's in The Atlantic.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you've been experiencing more negative anger lately? Do you see it affecting the people close to you in your life? Are you worried about the level of anger in American politics and society? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We continue our conversation with Charles Duhigg, journalist and author. His new piece in The Atlantic is The Real Roots of American Rage, the untold story of how anger became the dominant emotion in our politics and personal lives and what we can do about it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we as Americans are angrier, growing angrier as a society over time? Do you steer clear sometimes of maybe cable news or social media because you come away from it feeling angry? Do you want to step away from political news sometimes because you just feel like you get more and more outraged and don't want to feel that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Charles, let's talk about part two of the headline of your article. What can we do about it?
Yeah, it's a tough question, right? Because we are living in a time where not only is everyone very angry, but it feels good to be angry. And for many people, the path forward seems through anger. There's a lot of motivation there. And so what's important isn't to say you should give up on your anger. In fact, you should draw on your anger. Whether you believe that the country is moving in the right direction or in the wrong direction, anger will often be a reliable compass for what you ought to do next to make the world a better place. That's been true since the founding of this nation. But the question is, how do you stop that anger from boiling over into something destructive and corrosive, either in your own life or in the republic as a whole? And to do that, you really have to make a choice. You have to make a choice about what kind of anger you want to let into your life. A great example of this is just to ask people, sort of, what do you look at when you go on Facebook or Twitter? There was an experiment that was done in Israel. Israel is a great place to study a lot of this stuff because Israel knows anger like almost nobody else, right? It's been angry for a long time, and a lot of people are angry at it, and they live side by side. There was an experiment that was done a couple of years ago where a number of researchers created some advertisements for a very right-wing neighborhood. And rather than telling people they ought to be less angry, that they ought to calm down, what they said instead is you ought to be more angry to a ridiculous extreme. They would put up these posters that would say things like, if it wasn't for the conflict with the Palestinians, we wouldn't have any heroes. So thank God we're at war with the Palestinians because it gives us heroes. Or they would put up other things that say, we would have no idea how moral we were unless we had people to test that morality. Thank goodness for the conflict that allows us to be more moral. Now, this is ridiculous, right? Nobody is thankful for war because it creates war heroes. That's a terrible thing to say. But the idea behind it was, by making extremist statements, can we convince people to be less extremist themselves? As one researcher said to me, it's kind of like when you go to a baseball game and you shout something at the other team, and then the guy next to you, he starts shouting these terrible racist things at the other team. It makes you embarrassed you said anything in the first place. And that's exactly what they found happened, is that by saying extremist things, they actually convinced people to be more moderate in their own beliefs. Well, right now we live in a world in America where we see extremist things all the time, right? We see them on Facebook. The president says them. Sometimes the Democrats say them. All you have to do is go on Twitter and you'll see these insane insanely extremist things. And the question is, do you see that as a mirror that makes you think about your own thoughts and your own beliefs, or do you just passively accept it and pass it along? To become less angry, or at least to become angry in the right good way, we need to start thinking more about what our anger is and not just following those people who indulge in Schadenfreude, who love to tweet about their foes' missteps, but instead to start looking for the smart, angry voices who are saying, here's a way out of this. Here's a way forward.
I want to bring on a caller now. Nancy is with us in Ellsworth. Nancy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. And thanks for the discussion. Too much anger in America with all of the noise from the politics and things. I have found, though, that in the recovery community, AA or Narcotics Anonymous or any sort of self-help group, if people can come together with an idea of, yes, we've had bad things happen, but not to be blaming, not to be shaming, just to assess your injuries, kind of, and to move forward in a manner of healing. Letting go of the blame and the shame is really the way to go, and that helps us acknowledge our common humanity.
Nancy, thank you so much for the call. Charles, what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. Right? I think that if a sociologist was reflecting on that, what they would say is blaming and shaming is this instinct for retribution, right? It's this instinct to punish the other person rather than to acknowledge your own anger and try and use it for something productive. And Nancy's exactly right. I mean, when you think about things that make you angry in your own life, the right answer is not to bottle that up. It's not to say, to deny to yourself that you're angry. But it's also not to go find the person who made you angry and to try and exact justice or vengeance upon them. That's not going to make the situation better. What is going to make it better is to recognize, actually, this anger is telling me something important. It's telling me something about how I have to change or how I hope that other people change, and if they're not going to change, that I need to find different people to spend time around. And if I say something angry to a friend, they're probably very likely to listen to me very closely. But again, it's this question of how do we manage our own anger? You know, we talk about managing many other emotions. We talk about managing when you fall in love, that you should be hesitant to jump into marriage too quickly, right? Or to fall in love with a candidate and not listen closely to what they're actually saying. But when it comes to anger, we tend not to have that sophisticated conversation, but we ought to. And Nancy's exactly right. The recovery community has led the way on this in many ways in thinking about how do we treat anger as something that we ought to be sophisticated about rather than just saying it's good or bad.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. 30 seconds left. Charles, are we going to hit a point of peak anger where we start to have these conversations more?
I think we are right now, right? I think the reason why I wrote this piece and why it's a topic of conversation is people are furious and it's become a burden. It feels heavy to carry around, but there is a better way.
It's a good place to leave it. Charles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Charles Duhigg is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's the author of two books, The Power of Habit and Smarter, Faster, Better. He joined us to talk about his piece for The Atlantic. It's called The Real Roots of American Rage, The Untold Story of How Anger Became the Dominant Emotion in Our Politics and Personal Lives, and What We Can Do About It. And you can still share your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.